We have a special premium for first-time donors to Issues Etc. It's the new Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio mousepad. We'll send it to you for your first-time donation to Issues Etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make your first-time gift by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to LPR Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. Thanks for your support.
Hey, I'm a Catholic deer hunter. I am happy to be clinging to my guns and my religion.
Pro-life Democrats, you're out there. You need to go get active in your party. And really, we need to change from the ground up.
Mary is the mother of God in December, in Advent, and Christmas. She is also the mother of God on Epiphany. And she's the mother of God in February. She's the mother of God in August, too.
Preach that cross, the scandal of the cross, trusting this is the source of our salvation. And when we do, if the church gets smaller, so be it. But in the end, that is what really, truly builds the church.
Didgeridoo players in Iowa, love Issues, etc.
You would think that by, what, the 7th century here, this council that we're going to be talking about, the Third Council of Constantinople and our ongoing series on the seven ecumenical councils of the church, comes in the 7th century, and it is still trying to sort out some of the details, but important details nonetheless, on the person of Christ, his two natures, his one person. The question during this council, as brief as it is in the 7th century, is whether or not Christ has one or two wills. And why would that be important, you might ask? Well, we'll find out here in the course of this first half hour of Issues Etc. live this Wednesday. It's August the 22nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Pastor Heath Curtis will be our guest for the first half hour of Issues Etc. In the second part of the program, we'll do a sermon review, a sermon preached Sunday by Dr. Henry Cloud, who is a clinical psychologist, and he's written about three or four best-selling books on leadership and having, I don't know, good leadership habits, something like that. Doesn't really matter. He's going to be preaching a sermon at Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington, Illinois, a very influential mega church up there near Chicago. Sermon titled The Stages of Faith. And we'll see if he can manage to mention Jesus a single time during our sermon review that'll last about an hour. In the second hour of the program, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest from the Ruth Institute. We'll talk about GOP vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan and women's issues. Then, in the last few minutes of the program, some movie reviews. Pastor Jonathan Fisk of Worldview Everlasting will be our guest. We'll talk about The Bourne Legacy, a movie that I'm greatly looking forward to seeing, and The Expendables 2, one that I'm not looking forward to seeing, although it is star-packed. We'll just find out about both of those movies in the last half hour of Issues Etc. You can join us for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Talkback at issuesetc.org is our in-studio email address, or you can send us a tweet at IssuesETC. Pastor Heath Curtis is pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois, and Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois. He's author of the book Ordering Our Days in his piece, An Introduction to the Christian Church Year. Heath, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, Todd.
Why 7 centuries on here from the birth of Christ is the Christian church still trying to sort out the details of who Jesus is?
Right. Yeah. Today's topic, the Sixth Ecumenical Council, is almost dealing with a manufactured crisis. And that we're actually still dealing with the fallout from Chalcedon, the fourth council. So before we can get into tonight, we should do a little review before we get into today's council. And so what was declared at Chalcedon was that Jesus is one person. There's only one Jesus. So, but since he's both God and man, we say he has two natures. He's got a human nature and he's got a divine nature. And last week's council kind of cleared that up even a little more in one way and said, now, when we say Jesus is also a human being, we want to understand that Jesus is not some guy who was just born that God kind of adopted as his son. You know, it wasn't some individual person that God grabbed up into humanity. No, Jesus' human nature, the fancy word is on hypostatic. That is, it was not some person. It was not a personal human being. Jesus just took up, the Son of God took into himself a human nature. So he's one person, but he's not some random person off the street that God adopted. It's his very own human nature that he took from his mother Mary. And so we also say that that human nature is in hypostatic, that it's that human nature has been taken into the personality, the hypostasis of the Son of God. So two hypostases, three hypostases in the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, one of those persons, one hypostasis, the Son of God, now has a human nature, fully God, he's fully man, he's not some adopted human being into God, he's fully man. And we're going to call that fully God and fully man two natures. But back in 451 at Chalcedon, there was a group of Christians who were not comfortable with talking about it as two natures. They wanted to talk about it as one united God-man nature. And so they're called the Monophysites, the one nature party. And this division is now, in the era that we're talking about, has been going on for almost 200 years, and men in the church continue to see it as something that's bridgeable, something that should not have happened, something that was really driven by imperial politics and not theology, that the politics are driving the theology instead of the other way around. And so we've got a couple now in the 7th century. We've got a very energetic new emperor and a very energetic new patriarch of Constantinople, leader of the Western Church. And they together, their plan, and the emperor's name is Heraclius, and his plan is he wants to recapture all the lost provinces that the empire has lost to the Persians, to the folks who today we call Iranians. And he's got a guy that he can work with in Constantinople, this church leader, Sergius, and together their plan is to reconquer what the Persians have taken and to reunite, as far as possible, all of the empire, and that includes uniting it religiously. And so Sergius is looking for a solution to the problem. How do we get the Monophysites back? How do we get these Christians that they've got one way of talking about who Jesus is? They don't like to say two natures. They like to say that Jesus has got one composite nature of the divine, human, incarnate word. And how do we get them back? And his plan is to hold up Chalcedon. He's not gonna renege on Chalcedon. But he wants to come up with some oneness in Jesus to satisfy the concerns of the Monophysites. So he says, okay, let's try this. Maybe there's two natures in Jesus, God and man, but there's always one activity. There's one operation. When Jesus does something, he's doing it as one Jesus, and we're going to call that oneness his, in Greek, his energeia, his energy, his operation, his activity. And he said, maybe this will make all parties happy. And he starts circulating brochures and letters, and whether he made them up himself or whether somebody or whether he just honestly stumbled upon these forgeries of supposedly from, you know, respected churchmen of the past kind of supporting this idea of one energy in Jesus. This goes out. He draws a lot of people to his party. Heraclius is doing great guns, beating back the Persians, getting back the supposedly the true cross that the Persians had stole when they sacked Jerusalem. Everything's going great until, you know, a few voices in the Western Church say, now, wait a minute. Now, I thought we had this settled at Chalcedon, that, you know, whatever is not assumed is not saved. So how can you say that Jesus only has one operation when he's both God and man? And, you know, human beings, we operate, we have activity, our personhood, our nature is expressed in our actions and in everything about humanity that you might call an action. And also, of course, Godhood, you know, God's being is expressed in his actions and operations in the world. So don't we have to say that Jesus has got both a human action, operation, energy, and a divine operation, action, energy? And so these become the battle lines. And then the ground changes somewhat, and the terminologies, to make it all more confusing, terminologies change one more time. Into, we're not only going to talk about one energy in Jesus. Instead, let's talk about one will. That Jesus, he's God and he's man, but surely we can say, well, Jesus has only got one will. He wants always the same thing. It's not like the human nature and the divine nature can be at odds with each other. But again, the criticism is the same. If Jesus is really human and Jesus is really divine, doesn't having a will, isn't that part of being human? And isn't having a will part of being God? It's, you know, connected to the nature. So if you're going to say two natures, you got to say Jesus has two wills, two activities. And that's what this debate is about, and it's really all the best intentions, but Sergius has kind of created this argument in the church out of his godly desire to bring unity to the church.
We'll take a break when we come back. Pastor Heath Curtis is our guest, pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois, Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois, author of the book Ordering Our Days in His Peace, an introduction to the Christian church here. We're talking about the Third Council of Constantinople, which would be the sixth ecumenical council of the church, and it's the, just to confuse matters a little bit more, part seven of our weekly series on the seven ecumenical councils of the church. We're at about the late part of the seventh century, and Pastor Heath Curtis is our guest for another 10 minutes. Then we're going to do some sermon review, a sermon, if we can call it that, preached Sunday by Dr. Henry Cloud at Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington, Illinois. The title alone should cause concern. It's called Stages of Faith. We'll hear it in about 15 minutes here on Issues, Etc. What are the sources and origins of writings like the Book of Mormon, the Quran, and the Gospel of Thomas, and how do they compare to the Bible? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August is One Word, Many Writings, A Study of the Origins of Religious Writings. You can read an excerpt at issuesetc.org, or you can find out more about One Word, Many Writings by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. One Word, Many Writings by Dr. Adam Francisco.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Steadfast Lutherans, people who believe that traditional Lutheran preaching, liturgy, and hymnody continue to deliver Christ crucified for sinners today. The Reformation attempted to return the church's focus on what we do for God back to a focus on what God does for us, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures. Some things never change. The gospel is still under attack from inside and outside the church. To see how Lutheran doctrine and practice preserve the gospel, visit steadfastlutherans.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's our seven-part series. Actually, it's going to be an eight-part series. This is part seven of our weekly series on the seven ecumenical councils. We're talking about the Third Council of Constantinople. Pastor Heath Curtis is our guest. Heath, give us a little background here. You mentioned the encroaching Persians. Now, this would put us in 1680 in the very early stages of the rise of Islam. How are the two connected?
Well, what we have in the 610, 620, 630, 640s, we have the rise of Islam is going on in the 620s and 30s. And just previous to that, in the 610s and early 620s, is what I was talking about with Heraclius and the Persians, you know, going at it. So both the Persian Empire is greatly weakened, and the Byzantine, or what's left of the Roman Empire, is greatly weakened as well. And so when the Arabs come springing up from the south in the 630s and 40s, they find basically no resistance, it's obviously resistance at least weak enough for them to overcome, which is unimaginable even, you know, 100 years earlier, that things would come to such a pretty pass that these desert, you know, wanderers would be able to destroy these two great empires. I mean, there's no great technological advance or advance in tactics that let the Muslims win. It's simply by dint of numbers coming into these two weakened empires. And so Syria falls in 637, Armenia falls in 639, Egypt falls in 639. And that's amazing. Egypt was taken over by Romans in the 40s and 50s BC. So for almost 700 years, that's been a Roman province. And so I mean that's three times the age of our country. I mean, it's incomprehensible. Can you imagine, you know, this basic political structure that's lasted for seven centuries is overthrown all at once? 652, all of North Africa. 665, the rest of North Africa is finished up, I should say. It takes about 10 years. And Constantinople itself is laid siege for 4 years, from 674 to 678. So when this council takes place in 681, there's no more, there's no such thing as a Patriarch of Jerusalem or Antioch. There are guys who are called that, but they're living in Constantinople. They have no congregation. That is, to this point in history, still Arab lands. And so the whole landscape has changed, and you can see why there would be this greater desire for unity in the midst of all this chaos that's coming in from the outside. And eventually, of course, even the Western lands and the Western church will be affected by the Islamic invasion as we go through the 700s and the 800s. Finally turned back, you know, by Charles Martel in France, and turned back for a few centuries by Constantinople. But this really changes everything. And I think that we're going to see the bad fruit in Christian theology of the reaction against Islam. We're going to see that in the seventh so-called ecumenical council, which has never been popular with Lutherans or other people of the Reformation tradition.
So for the Christian West at this point of this council, Third Council of Constantinople, it's kind of like, poor analogy, but having a 9/11 every 10 years for about five decades running, and watching once believed eternal territories of Christendom being given over to the Muslims.
Yeah, you know, I haven't even mentioned what's going on in the West as far as invasions from the Slavic peoples, the Avars, the Bulgars, then Germanic peoples. The Visigoths reconquer Spain, and a lot of them are still Aryan at this late date. It really is unimaginable, you know, what happens. The Roman province of Illyrium, for example, and the Danubian provinces, what today we call the former Yugoslavia, that was all Greek-speaking. Those were all Greeks, and they had been Greeks for thousands of years. And then all of a sudden, you know, we think of them today as the Slavic lands. Well, that's when this happens, in the 7th century A.D. Up to that time, that's kind of a mixed Latin and Greek population. And so the world, this is one of those epochs in world history where everything is changing. Everything.
Why was it so important, although, as you said before, this is kind of a manufactured crisis, the result of politics and desperation to unite Christendom such as it was at the time. Why is it important, nonetheless, that the church was able to assert that Christ, having two natures in one person, possesses, in the end, they're talking about two energies or two wills? Why is that theologically important?
It's still important because it comes back to this phrase we've mentioned again and again that goes back to the early period in church history, the early patristic period, that whatever is not assumed by Christ is not saved. If you leave anything out of Jesus' humanity, then our salvation is really lost. And so the argument about who Jesus is and all these pieces to the puzzle, does Jesus have a human will? Does he have a human energy? What does it mean? Can Jesus really be human if he's sinless? How does sin apply to human nature? All these questions, they have ramifications all through salvation, not only because you're talking about who is Jesus, but by everything you're talking about who is Jesus, you're also discussing what is humanity? You know, who are we? If we don't understand who we are in relation to God, if we don't understand what humanity is and what God is, then we really know nothing, then we don't know God at all. And so we have to, in understanding Jesus, I'm not the first to say it. This is David Skier's line, but that all theology is Christology, that everything we think and say theologically, it all comes down to Jesus. And so by answering who is Jesus, we find out who are we, who is God the Father, what is our eternal destiny. That's all wrapped up in what you say about who Jesus is.
So in the end, just because the question is inevitable, Christ, having two natures, divine and human, complete two natures, has two wills, but while those wills are two and distinct, are they in perfect concert?
Yeah, of course, because Jesus is born as a human being without sin. He's born in a state of righteousness. And so his will is free to always choose the good. He has real free will, not free will to choose between good and evil, but free will that always desires and is in harmony with the will of God. And so that's who Jesus is. He's perfected humanity. He is what we shall be on the last day. As St. Paul says, it's not yet appeared what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him. Oh, and, there's one other important thing we can't forget as Lutherans about this ecumenical council. They condemn a pope as a heretic. Pope Honorius I kind of came out in favor of this monothelitism or monoenergism. And so this ecumenical council condemns Pope Honorius and four ecumenical patriarchs of Constantinople. And so it's another stepping stone in this, another milepost in this story of the councils asserting the church's independence from any of these extravagant claims of the Pope in Rome.
Next time, when we conclude our series, we're going to be talking about the Seventh Ecumenical Council, and that's going to be next week, talking about the Second Council of Nicaea. That would be in the latter part of the 8th century. What can we expect next week? About a minute here, Heath.
We might call it in now for something completely different. We're going to talk a lot about how this is a council that I'll spend some time especially talking about the Lutheran theologian, the great Lutheran theologian Martin Chemnitz, who has not a good word to say about this council. This is something that really divides, for lack of a better term, Protestant Christians from both Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox believers on this question of how we interact with the saints and with images of the saints and of our Lord.
That's next week on Issues Etc., part 8 of our weekly series on the Seven Ecumenical Councils of the Church with Pastor Heath Curtis. Pastor Curtis is pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Warden, Illinois, and Zion Lutheran Church in Carpenter, Illinois, and he's author of the book Ordering Our Days in His Peace, An Introduction to the Christian Church Year. It's a great book. It gives a simple introduction. If you've never followed the church here, if you come from a congregation, sadly, that's robbed you of that lifelong privilege, or if you, it's been your companion all throughout your life, Sunday by Sunday, the church year, you can always learn more. Find out more about this great book called Ordering Our Days in His Peace from Concordia Publishing House, authored by Pastor Heath Curtis. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040, or you can browse before you buy not only that, but other publications from Pastor Curtis at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Heath, thank you very much. Look forward to next time.
Sounds good, Todd. Thank you.
When we come back, we're going to do a little sermon review here on Issues, Etc. We do the good and the bad and the ugly. And this next one, although it is couched in very nice and general language being preached by Dr. Henry Cloud at Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington, Illinois, a sermon titled Stages of Faith, I think when we're done reviewing it, not to tip my hand too much, but I got to be honest with you, I think it will fall into the ugly category. Now remember, whenever we review a sermon, we're always following that three-part diagnostic. I'll talk a little bit more about it on the other side of the break, but in short form, it is how often is Jesus mentioned? Is Jesus the subject of the verbs? And in the end, what are those verbs? What is the preacher telling you that Jesus has done, is doing, will do for you? It's a basic diagnostic for understanding whether or not what you're hearing preached on Sunday morning is Christ-centered and cross-focused. When we come back, we'll review that sermon for the next hour of Issues, Etc. We're coming to you live this Wednesday afternoon, August the 22nd. We have a special premium for first-time donors to Issues, Etc. It's the new Issues, Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio mousepad. We'll send it to you for your first-time donation to Issues, Etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make your first-time gift by check. Make your check payable to Issues, Etc. and send it to LPR Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Well, Justin has completed his summer work at Sylvan Learning Center in Edwardsville. His reading comprehension has improved more than 3 grade levels, and his vocabulary has increased almost an entire grade level. Sylvan Learning Center of Edwardsville has a 6-week back-to-school boot camp. Their phone number, 618-656-0500, 618-656-0500. Emily has 4 weeks left at Sylvan. A report on her progress next time.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. Augsburg Lutheran, Shawnee, Kansas. Peace Lutheran, Fresno, California. Trinity Lutheran, Casper, Wyoming. Memorial Lutheran, Houston, Texas. Trinity Lutheran, Gillette, Wyoming. Our Savior Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California. St. Mary's Lutheran, Des Moines, Iowa. Redeemer Lutheran, Kakabeka Falls, Ontario, Canada. St. Jacoby Lutheran, Shawano, Wisconsin. And St. John's Lutheran, North Prairie, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues, Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues, Etc. 300.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
For years, I've been saying the abortion industry targets Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. Black women have 36% of all abortions, even though they make up only 13% of the population. Our past research shows a majority of Planned Parenthood abortion mills are located in neighborhoods with high Black and Hispanic populations. Now, another piece of glaring and shameful evidence. Ashutosh Vermani, a Charlotte, North Carolina abortionist, was confronted about his deadly career. He responded by telling pro-lifers to, quote, adopt one of those ugly Black babies. This is blatant racism and further proof the abortion industry doesn't want what they view as less than desirable people reproducing. Visit today's broadcast link at lifeissues.org to view the brief video.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.